The top 10 now include World War II, number 1, World War I, number 3, the Russian Civil War, number 8, Mao, number 10, and an event that didn't even make Pinker's original list, the Rwandan genocide, number 7, where 700,000 people were killed in 100 days. Footnote: the full list, figures in deaths per year approximate. 1. World War II, 11 million. 2. An Lushan Rebellion, 4.5 million. 3. World War I, 3 million. 4 and 5, Taiping Rebellion and Tamerlane, each 2.8 million. 6. Fall of the Ming Dynasty, 2.5 million. 7 and 8, Mongol Conquests and Rwandan Genocide, each 2.4 million. 9. Russian Civil War, 1.8 million. 10. Russia's 16th-17th century Time of Troubles, 1.5 million. 11. Mao-induced Chinese famines, 1.4 million. This suggests both good and bad news. Compared with the past, we are extraordinarily different in terms of whom we extend rights to and feel empathy for and what global ills we counter. And things are better in terms of fewer people acting violently and societies attempting to contain them. But the bad news is that the reach of the violent few is ever greater. They don't just rage about events on another continent. They travel there and wreak havoc. The charismatically violent inspire thousands in chat rooms instead of a mob in their village. Like-minded lone wolves more readily meet and metastasize. And the chaos once let loose with a cudgel or machete occurs now with an automatic weapon or bomb, with far more horrific consequences. Things have improved, but that doesn't mean they're good. Thus, we now consider insights provided by this book that might help. Some traditional routes. First, there's the strategy for reducing violence that stretches back tens of thousands of years. Moving. If two individuals in a hunter-gatherer band are having tensions, one frequently shifts to a neighboring band, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes not. Similarly, inter-band tensions are reduced when one shifts to a different location, an advantage of nomadicism. A recent study of the hunter-gathering Hadza of Tanzania showed an additional benefit to this fluidity straight out of Chapter 10. Specifically, it facilitates highly cooperative individuals associating with one another. Then there are the beneficial effects of trade, as emphasized by anthropologists as well as Pinker. From trading at a village market to signing international trade agreements, it is often true that where goods do not pass frontiers, armies will. It's a version of Thomas Friedman's somewhat tongue-in-cheek Golden Arches theory of peace. Countries with McDonald's don't fight one another. While there are exceptions, e.g. the U.S. invasion of Panama, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, Friedman's broad point holds. Countries that are sufficiently stable that they are integrated into global markets with the likes of McDonald's and prosperous enough that their people keep those establishments in business likely conclude that the trade advantages of peace outweigh the imagined spoils of war. This isn't surefire. For example, despite being major trading partners, Germany and the UK fought World War I. And there's no shortage of people willing to go to war, even at the cost of disrupted trade and scarce commodities. Moreover, trade is double-edged. It's certifiably groovy when occurring between indigenous rainforest hunters. It's certifiably vile if you're protesting the WTO. But as long as countries can wage war on distant nations, long-distance trade that makes them interdependent is a good deterrent. Cultural diffusion in general, which includes trade, can also facilitate peace. This can have a modern tint. Across 189 countries, digital access predicts increased civil liberties and media freedom. Moreover, the more civil liberties in a neighboring country, the stronger this effect, as ideas flow with goods. Religion. Well, I'd love to skip this section, but I can't. That's because religion is arguably our most defining cultural invention, an incredibly powerful catalyst for both our best and worst behaviors. When introducing the pituitary in Chapter 4, I didn't feel obliged to first disclose my feelings about the gland, but the equivalent feels appropriate here. Thus, I was raised highly observant and orthodox, felt intensely religious, but then, around age 13, the whole edifice collapsed. Ever since, I've been incapable of any religiosity or spirituality and more readily focus on religion's destructive than its beneficial aspects. But I like being around religious people and am moved by them, while baffled by how they can believe that stuff. And I fervently wish that I could. The end. As emphasized in Chapter 9, we've created a staggering variety of religions. In considering solely religions with worldwide reaches, there are some important commonalities. A. They all involve facets of religiosity that are intensely personal, solitary, and individualized, as well as facets that are about community. As we'll see, these are very different realms when it comes to fostering our best and worst behaviors. B. All involve personal and communal ritualized behaviors that comfort in times of anxiety. However, many of those anxieties were created by the religion itself. The anxiety-reducing effects of belief are logical, given that psychological stress is about lack of control, predictability, outlets, and social support. Depending on the religion, belief brings an explanation for why things happen. A conviction that there is a purpose, and the sense of a creator who is interested in us, who is benevolent, and who responds to human entreaties, who preferentially responds to entreaties from people like you. No wonder religiosity has health benefits, independent of the community support that it brings and the decreased rates of substance abuse. Recall the role of the anterior cingulate cortex, ACC, in sounding an alarm when there is a discrepancy between how you thought things worked and how they actually do. After controlling for personality and cognitive abilities, more religious people show less ACC activation when getting news of a negative discrepancy. Other studies show the anxiety-reducing effects of repetitive religious rituals. C. Finally, all the world religions distinguish between us and them, though they differ as to what is required to be an us and whether the pertinent attributes are immutable. Enough is known about the neurobiology of religiosity that there's even a journal called Religion, Brain, and Behavior. Reciting a familiar prayer activates mesolimbic dopaminergic systems. Improvising one activates regions associated with theory of mind as you try to understand a deity's perspective. God wants me to be humble in addition to grateful. Better make sure I mention that. Moreover, more activation of this theory of mind network correlates with a more personified image of a deity. Believing that someone is faith-healing deactivates the cognitive DLPFC, suspending disbelief. And performing a familiar ritual activates cortical regions associated with habit and reflexive evaluation. So are religious people nicer than non-religious ones? It depends on whether they're interacting with in- or out-group members. Okay, are religious people nicer to in-group members? Numerous studies say yes. More volunteering, with or without a religious context, charitable giving, and spontaneous prosociality, more generosity, trust, honesty, and forgiveness in economic games. However, numerous studies show no differences. Why the discrepancy? For starters, it matters whether data are self-reported. Religious people tend to inflate reports of their prosociality more than do non-religious people. Another factor is whether the prosociality is public. Conspicuous display is particularly important to those religious people who strongly need social approval. As more context dependency, in one study, religious people were more charitable than non-religious ones, but only on their Sabbath. Another important issue, what kind of religion? As introduced in Chapter 9, Ara Noren Zion, Azim Sharif, and Joseph Henrich of the University of British Columbia have identified links between features of various religions and aspects of prosociality. As we saw, small band cultures, such as hunter-gatherers, rarely invent moralizing deities. It is not until cultures are large enough that people regularly interact anonymously with strangers that it becomes commonplace to invent a judgmental god. the Judeo-Christian/Muslim deity. In such cultures, overt and subliminal religious cues boost pro-sociality. In one study, religious subjects unscrambled sentences that did or didn't contain religious terms, e.g. spirit, divine, sacred. Doing the former prompted generosity afterward. This is reminiscent of Chapter 3's finding that merely seeing a pair of eyes posted on a wall makes people more pro-social. And showing that this is about being monitored, unscrambling sentences with secular terms such as jury, police, or contract had the same effect. Thus, reminders of a judgmental god or gods boosts pro-sociality. It also matters what that deity does about transgressions. Within and among cultures, the more punitive the god, the more generosity to an anonymous co-religionist. Do punitive gods make for more punitive people, at least in an economic game? In one study, no. Save your cash, God's got it covered. In another, yes, a punitive god would want me to be punitive as well. The UBC group has shown something ironic. Priming people to think of God as punitive decreases cheating. Thinking of God as forgiving increases it. The researchers then studied subjects from 67 countries, considering the prevalence in each of belief in the existence of a heaven and hell. The greater the skew toward belief in hell rather than heaven, the lower the national crime rate. When it comes to eternity, sticks apparently work better than carrots. And what about religion facilitating the worst in us with respect to thems? Well, one piece of evidence for this is, like human history. Every major religion has historical blood on its hands. Buddhist monks led the persecution of Rohingya Muslims in Burma, and a Quaker in the White House oversaw the carpet bombing of North Vietnam for Christmas. This ranges from religious wars, which are, to cite a quote generally attributed to Napoleon, people killing each other over who has the better imaginary friend, to secular ones, where, nevertheless, omniscient support is requested and proclaimed. Religion is a particularly tenacious catalyst of violence. Catholics and Protestants have been killing each other in Europe for nearly 500 years, Shiites and Sunnis for 1,300. Violent disagreements about differing economic or governmental models never last as long. This would be like people still killing each other today over, say, Eastern Roman Emperor Heraclius's 610 decision to switch the official language from Latin to Greek. As shown in a study of 600 terrorist groups spanning 40 years, religiously based terrorism persists the longest and is least likely to subside due to fighters joining the political process. Religious primes foster out-group hostility. In a field study, where people were surveyed in different locations in a cosmopolitan European city, merely walking past a church made Christians express more conservative, negative attitudes toward non-Christians. Another study examined the priming effects of a violent god. Subjects read a Bible passage in which a woman is murdered by a mob from another tribe. Her husband consults with his tribesmen and forms an army that takes revenge by attacking the other tribe, in biblical fashion, destroying their cities and killing every human and animal. Half the subjects were told this story. In the story told to the other half, while contemplating revenge, the army asks for advice from God, who sanctions them to majorly chasten the other tribe. Participants then played a competitive game in which each round's loser was blasted with a loud noise at a volume chosen by the other player. Reading the scene where God sanctions their desire for violence increased the volume with which opponents were chastened. No surprise, the effect was bigger in males than in females. Big surprise, subjects were either devout Mormons at Brigham Young University or students of typically liberal religions at a Dutch university. And the effect was equally strong in both groups. Biggest surprise, even among subjects who did not subscribe to the Bible, a surprisingly high 1% of the Brigham Young students and 73% of the Dutch, godly sanction increased their aggressiveness, though to a lesser extent. Thus, divine sanction of violence can increase aggression even in people whose religiosity probably doesn't include a vengeful God, as well as among those who don't even believe there's divine anything. Of course, this is not a uniform effect of religion. Noren Zion distinguishes between private and communal religiosity in surveying support for suicide bombers among Palestinians. In a refutation of Islam equals terrorism idiocy, people's personal religiosity, as assessed by how often they prayed, didn't predict support for terrorism. However, frequently attending services at a mosque did. The author then polled Indian Hindus, Russian Orthodox adherents, Israeli Jews, Indonesian Muslims, British Protestants, and Mexican Catholics as to whether they die for their religion, and whether people of other religions caused the world's troubles. In all cases, frequent attendance of religious services, but not frequent prayer, predicted those views. It's not religiosity that stokes intergroup hostility. It's being surrounded by co-religionists who affirm parochial identity, commitment, and shared loves and hatreds. This is hugely important. What should one make of these various findings? Religiosity isn't going anywhere. Given that, it seems that boosting in-group sociality is best done with a moralizing, punitive God. The standard, wearisome critique of atheism is that lack of a God or gods produces nihilistic amorality. The standard response is that it's pretty unimpressive if you are kind only because you fear damnation. Unimpressive or not, it appears to be useful. The big challenge is when communal aspects of religiosity fuel out-group hostility. It's useless to call for religions to broaden the extent of their usness. Religions are quirky as to who is an us, ranging from only those who look, act, talk, and pray like people in our sect to all of life. It will be discouragingly tough to shift religions from the former to the latter. Contact. As introduced in Chapter 11, many have speculated that intergroup tensions are reduced by contact. When people get to know one another, everyone gets along. But despite that salutary possibility, intergroup contact readily elevates hostilities. As seen in Chapter 9, intergroup contact worsens things when the two groups are treated unequally or are unequal in number, where the smaller group is surrounded, where intergroup boundaries are ambiguous, when the groups vie to display symbols of their sacred values, e.g. Northern Irish Protestants marching with Orangemen flags through Catholic neighborhoods. Elbows rubbed raw. Obviously, the opposite is needed to minimize threat and anxiety, groups encountering each other in equal numbers and treatment. In a neutral setting free of agitprop and where there is institutional oversight of the venture, most important, interactions work best when there is a shared goal, especially when it is successful. This revisits Chapter 11. A shared goal reprioritizes us-them dichotomies, bringing this novel combined us to the forefront. Under those conditions, sustained intergroup contact generally decreases prejudices, often to a large extent and in a generalized, persistent manner. This was the conclusion of a 2006 meta-analysis of some 500 studies comprising over 250,000 subjects from 38 countries. Beneficial effects were roughly equal for group differences in race, religion, ethnicity, or sexual orientation. As examples, a 1957 study concerning desegregation of the merchant marines showed that the more trips white seamen took with African Americans, the more positive their racial attitudes. Same for white cops as a function of time spent with African-American partners. A more recent meta-analysis provides additional insights. A. The beneficial effects typically involve both more knowledge about and more empathy for the thems. B. The workplace is a particularly effective place for contact to do its salutary thing. Decreased prejudice about the thems at work often generalizes to thems at large, and even sometimes to other types of thems. C. Contact between a traditionally dominant group and a subordinate minority usually decreases prejudice more in the former, the latter have higher thresholds. C. Novel routes of interacting, such as sustained online relationships, can work a bit as well. All good news. Contact theory has prompted an experimental approach where people, most typically adolescents or young adults, from groups in conflict, are brought together for anything from one-hour discussions to summer camps. They most frequently involved Palestinians and Israelis, Northern Irish Catholics and Protestants, or opposing groups from the Balkans, Rwanda, or Sri Lanka, with the idea that participants will return home and spread their attitudinal shifts. This notion of germination prompted the name of one such program, Seeds of Peace. Group pictures show Muslims and Jews, Catholics and Protestants, Tutsis and Hutu, Croats and Bosnians, arm in arm. This is better than puppies. Do the programs work? Depends on what counts as working. According to one expert, Stephen Workle of the University of Hawaii, effects are generally positive. Less fear and more positive views of thems, more of a perception of thems as heterogeneous, more recognition of faults of the us, and more of a perception of oneself as an atypical us. This is the immediate aftermath. Disappointingly, these effects are usually transient. Individuals from across lines rarely stay in touch. In one survey of Palestinian and Israeli teenagers, 91% were not. Persistent reductions in prejudice usually involve exceptionalism. Yes, most thems are awful, but I hung out with a them once who was okay. When there is a major transformation, the peacemongering convert loses street cred back home when they broadcast this. For example, no prominent peace activist has emerged from the thousands of participants in the Middle Eastern Seeds of Peace. Footnote. Another limitation of the approach is that by definition there is a self-selection for participants willing to entertain the possibility of détente with thems. Moreover, participants often come from privileged socioeconomic backgrounds, limiting their ability to go and transform the masses afterward. Here's a way to think about contact. Instead of hating a them for what his ancestors did, you await the day that you're irritated with him for, say, eating the last s'more, or setting the office thermostat too low, or never returning to its proper place in the barn, that plowshare that used to be a sword. Now, that's progress. The core of that thought is Susan Fiske's demonstration that automatic other race face amygdala responses can be undone when subjects think of that face as belonging to a person, not a them. The ability to individuate even monolithic and de-individuated monsters can be remarkable. A moving example of this is told by Phumla Gobodo-Madikizela in her book, A Human Being Died That Night, A South African Story of Forgiveness, Cape Town, David Philip, 2003. Gobodo-Madikizela, raised in a black township of apartheid South Africa, managed to forge an educational path all the way to a PhD in clinical psychology. As a free South Africa dawned, she worked on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where she had a task to give anyone pause. It concerned Eugene de Kock, the man with the most literal apartheid-era blood on his hands. De Kock had commanded the elite counterinsurgency unit of the South African police and personally overseen kidnappings, torture, and murders of black activists. He had been tried, convicted, and given a life sentence. Gobodo-Madikizela was to interview him about his death squad. Clinical psychologist that she is, over the course of 40 hours talking with him, her main focus became to understand this man. He was a predictably multifaceted, contradictory, real human, rather than an archetype. He was remorseful in some ways, unrepentant in others, indifferent to some of his appalling brutality, while proud of his patchwork of principles about whom he wouldn't kill. He pointed fingers at his bosses, who mostly escaped justice by depicting him as a rogue vigilante, rather than the civil servant of apartheid that he was, while emphasizing his command of his killers. He shattered her by tentatively asking if he had killed any of her loved ones. He had not. And Gobodo-Madikizela found herself deeply troubled by her growing empathy for de Kock. A defining moment came one day when de Kock was recounting something that made him markedly distressed. Gobodo Madikizela reflexively reached out and, a taboo act, touched his finger between the jail bars. The next morning, her arm felt leaden, as if paralyzed by the touch. She struggled with whether her granting him this contact was a sign of her power or his, with him somehow manipulating her into the act. When she next saw him, he compounded her storm of feelings by thanking her and confessing that it was his trigger hand that she had touched. No, this was not the start of an unlikely friendship, as violins play in the background, but the automaticity, the empathy implicit in her reaching out to him, shows that somehow, remarkably, the tenuous elements of usness she now shared with de Kock had dominated at that moment. Burning and unburning bridges. A phenomenon in many settings of conflict is burning cultural bridges as a way to forge a new, powerful us category. Consider the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya in the 1950s. The brunt of British colonialism in Kenya had focused on one tribe, the Kikuyu, who had the bad luck of living on precisely the rich farmland that the colonials appropriated. Kikuyu's suffering finally boiled over into the Mau Mau insurrection. Footnote. The British eventually crushed the rebellion at the cost of approximately 150 British lives and 10,000 to 20,000 Kikuyu lives, and then handed over power to hand-picked, uber-westernized Kenyans rather than Mau Mau guerrilla fighters. As a measure of how successful the anglicized handoff was, more than 50 years later, black Kenyan judges still wear powdered wigs when presiding. The agricultural Kikuyu were not particularly bellicose, unlike, say, the nearby pastoralist Maasai, who had been terrorizing the Kikuyu forever. And inculcating new Mau Mau fighters required powerful symbolic effort. Oath-making had great cultural significance to Kikuyus, and Mau Mau oath-making notoriously involved horrendous violations of Kikuyu norms and taboos, acts guaranteeing shunning at home. The message was clear. You have burned a bridge. Your only us is us. This strategy is often used in a horrifying realm of modern violence, namely rebel groups transforming kidnapped children into soldiers. Sometimes this involves new recruits having to burn symbolic cultural bridges, but also, perhaps reflecting recognition of kids' limited abstract cognition, something more concrete is employed. The forced killing of family members by such children. We are your family now. When child soldiers are liberated, their chances of growing into healthy, functioning adults soars if a relative is found who will accept them. If a bridge is unburned. As I write, there's news of the rescue of a few of the 200-plus Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped in 2014 by the terrorist group Boko Haram. What these girls experienced is unimaginable. Terror, pain, forced labor, endless rapes, pregnancies, AIDS. And as these few are returned home, many are shunned for their AIDS, for the belief that they've been brainwashed into being sleeper terrorists, for the rape-born children they carry. This does not augur well for their being anything other than broken forever. Chapter 11 emphasized pseudo-speciation, when thems are made to seem so different that they hardly count as human. Chapter 15 considered the skill of demagogues at this, framing hated thems as insects, rodents, bacteria, malignancies, and feces. That provides a clear punchline. Be wary of rabble-rousers who frame thems as things to step on, spray with toxins, or flush down toilets. Simple. But pseudo-speciating propaganda can be subtler. In the fall of 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait, and in the run-up to the Gulf War, Americans were sickened by a story that emerged. On October 10, 1990, a 15-year-old refugee from Kuwait appeared before a congressional human rights caucus. The girl, she would give only her first name, Naira, had volunteered in a hospital in Kuwait City. She tearfully testified that Iraqi soldiers had stolen incubators to ship home as plunder, leaving over 300 premature infants to die. Our collective breath was taken away. These people leave babies to die on the cold floor. They are hardly human. The testimony was seen on the news by approximately 45 million Americans, was cited by 7 senators when justifying their support of war, a resolution that passed by 5 votes, and was cited more than 10 times by George H.W. Bush in arguing for U.S. military involvement. And we went to war with a 92% approval rating of the president's decision. In the words of Representative John Porter, Republican, Illinois, who chaired the committee, after Naira's testimony, we have never heard, in all this time, in all circumstances, a record of inhumanity and brutality and sadism as the ones that Naira had given us today. Much later, it emerged that the incubator story was a pseudo-speciating lie. The refugee was no refugee. She was Naira al-Sabah, the 15-year-old daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States. The incubator story was fabricated by the public relations firm Hill & Knowlton, hired by the Kuwaiti government with the help of Porter and co-chair Representative Tom Lantos, Democrat, California. Research by the firm indicated that people would be particularly responsive to stories about atrocities against babies, you think? So the incubator tale was concocted, the witness coached. The story was disavowed by human rights groups, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the media, and the testimony was withdrawn from the congressional record long after the war. Be careful when our enemies are made to remind us of maggots and cancer and shit. But also beware when it is our empathic intuitions, rather than our hateful ones, that are manipulated by those who use us for their own goals. Cooperation. As explored in Chapter 10, understanding the evolution of cooperation poses two challenges. The first is the fundamental problem of how cooperation ever starts. The dispiriting logic of the prisoner's dilemma shows that whoever takes the first cooperative step becomes one step behind. As we saw, one plausible solution concerns founder populations, when a subset of a population becomes isolated and its average degree of relatedness rises, fueling cooperation through kin selection. Should that founder population rejoin the general population, their cooperative tendencies will outcompete everyone else, thus propagating cooperation. Another solution involves green beard effects, that poor man's version of kin selection, where a genetic trait generates a conspicuous marker and a cooperative bent toward bearers of that marker. In that setting, the green beardless will be outcompeted unless they also evolve cooperation. As we saw, green beard effects occur in various species. This raises the second challenge, namely understanding why humans are so extraordinarily cooperative with non-relatives. We hold elevator doors open for strangers, take turns at four-way stop signs, get off buses in an orderly manner. We build cultures involving millions of people sharing conventions. This requires more than founder effects and green beards. In the years since Hamilton and Axelrod made tit-for-tat trendy, tons of work has explored human-specific mechanisms for fostering cooperation. There are many. Open-ended play. Two individuals play the prisoner's dilemma, knowing that after a single round, they'll never meet again. Rationality decrees that you defect. There'll never be a chance to catch up if you fall behind in that first round. What about two rounds? Well, the second round requires non-cooperation for the same reasons the single-round game does. In other words, it never makes sense to cooperate in the final round. Thus, round two behavior determined, the game defaults to a single-round game, where the rational strategy is to defect. Three rounds? The same. In other words, playing for a known number of rounds biases against cooperation, and the more rational the players, the more they foresee this. It's open-ended play that fosters cooperation, an unknown number of rounds producing the shadow of the future, where retribution is possible and the advantages of sustained mutual cooperation accumulate with increasing numbers of interactions. Multiple games. Two individuals play two games against each other simultaneously, alternating rounds between the two, where one game has a much lower threshold for establishing cooperation than the other. Once cooperation is established in that less cutthroat game, there is psychological spillover of cooperation into the other. This is why managers of tense, competitive offices bring in soothing outsiders to lead trust games, hoping that the low threshold demands for trust there will spill over into work life. Open book play. This is where the other player can see if you've been a jerk to people in the past. Reputation is a powerful facilitator of cooperation. That's what a moralizing God is about, the book whose play is eternally open. As we saw in Chapter 9, everyone from hunter-gatherers to urbanites gossip, doing so to open reputation books wider. Open book play mediates a uniquely sophisticated type of human cooperation, namely indirect reciprocity. Person A helps person B, who helps C, who helps D. The reciprocity between two individuals in a closed interaction is like barter. But indirect pay-it-forward reciprocity is like money, where the common currency is reputation. Punishment. Other animals don't have reputations or ponder whether their interactions are open-ended. However, punishment to promote cooperation occurs in numerous species. This is shown when a male baboon who is being an aggressive brute to a female is chased out of the troop for a while by the victim and her relatives. Punishment can strongly facilitate cooperation, but its implementation is potentially double-edged in humans. All cultures show some degree of willingness to pay a cost to punish norm violators, and high degrees of willingness correlate with high levels of pro-sociality. One study examined rural Ethiopians who subsisted on selling charcoal made from wood from local forests, a classic tragedy of the commons scenario. No one is likely to spontaneously limit logging to keep the forest healthy. The study showed that villages with high average levels of willingness to administer costly punishment in an economic game were the ones with the most patrols to prevent overcutting of trees and the healthiest forests. And as seen in Chapter 9, cultures with gods who punish norm violations are atypically pro-social. A complication in costly punishment is the cost. The danger that the costs of monitoring for and punishing violations may outweigh the benefits of the cooperation induced. A solution is to reduce surveillance after long stretches of cooperation. In other words, to trust. For example, probably very few Amish purchase costly retinal scanner home security systems. Another complication concerns who does the punishing. In other species, it is usually the victim, the second party. By definition, punishment in two-person games in humans, e.g. the ultimatum game, is always by the second party. In that setting, the punisher forgoes the measly share offered, A, in the hopes of deriving visceral satisfaction from depriving the first party of their larger share, and, as seen in the last chapter, that is a major motivator of punishment, fueled by the amygdala and insula. B, in an effort to shape the first party into making fairer offers to the second party in the future. Or, C, as an altruistic act, hoping to shape the first party into being more decent to whomever they play next. This is complex for second parties, balancing costs and benefits, heart and mind, birds in the hand, and in the bush. It might also result in the first party being offended by the rejection and becoming even less cooperative thereafter, an outcome in some game scenarios. Humans uniquely and very effectively boost cooperation through third-party punishment meted out by objective outsiders. However, such punishing can be costly to the third party, meaning that there's the evolutionary challenge not just of jump-starting cooperation, but also of jump-starting altruistic third-party punishment. The answer, as repeatedly derived by humans, is to add layers. develop secondary punishment, punishing someone who fails to do third-party punishment, the world of honor codes, where you're punished if you don't report a violation. An alternative is to reward third-party punishers. Humans make livings as cops and judges. Moreover, recent theoretical and empirical work shows that being a conspicuous third-party punisher makes people trust you. But who monitors third-party punishers? Here is where you get people to share and lower the cost by taking sociality to the max. Costs are shouldered by everyone, and free riders are punished, e.g., we pay taxes and punish tax evaders. When the moving parts are balanced, you generate extraordinary levels of cooperation. The moving parts were examined in a fascinating 2010 science paper. The author studied 113,000 online participants, who each purchased an item, a souvenir photo, under one of the following conditions. A. Could buy for a set price. This was the control condition. B. Could pay whatever they wanted. Sales soared, but people tended to pay tiny amounts, putting the store in the red. C. Were charged the original price, knowing that the company gave X percent of earnings to charity. Sales increased, but less than X percent, and the store lost money. D. Could pay whatever they wanted, with half of that going to a charity. This boosted both sales and the price voluntarily paid, yielding profits for the store and a large charitable contribution. In other words, while evidence of corporate social responsibility, scenario C, boosts sales a bit, it's far more effective when the individual and the business share social responsibility and the individual determines the amount of money donated. Choosing your partner. As we've seen, cooperators outcompete more numerous non-cooperators to the extent that the former can find one another. This is the logic behind green beards facilitating finding a kindred soul, if not kin. Thus, when that element is introduced into a game, with the ability to refuse to play with someone, cooperation soars, and more cheaply than by punishing defectors. These findings reveal numerous theoretical routes for fostering cooperation, and with real-life equivalents. Moreover, we've learned a lot about which work best when. This is how we've evolved to collectively raise barns for neighbors, plant and harvest the whole village's rice crop, or coordinate marching band members to form a picture of their school's mascot. And, oh yeah, to reiterate an idea aired previously, cooperation is a value-free term. Sometimes it takes a village to ransack a neighboring village. Reconciliation, and things that are not synonymous with it. So I'd caught a colobus monkey and was eating, getting to the good part, when this guy comes by, starts really begging for some. This got on my nerves and I snarled at him. Instead of taking a hint, he lunges, grabs the monkey's arm, starts yanking. So I bit his shoulder. He cleared out fast and sat at the other end of the clearing, his back to me. Once I calmed down, I thought a bit. To be honest, I probably should have shared some food with him. And while he definitely crossed a line when he grabbed, I probably should have nipped him instead of a real bite. So I'm feeling kind of bad. And besides, we work well together on patrols. It's probably good if we sort things out. So I take the monkey, sit near him. We're all awkward. He's not looking at me. I pretend there's a nettle between my toes. But eventually I give him some of the meat. He grooms me a bit. The whole thing was stupid. We should have done that in the first place. If you're a chimp, reconciliation is easy once your heart rate returns to normal. Sometimes for us, too. Touch a friend's shoulder, give a self-effacing grimace, say, "Hey, look, just now I was being a..." and they cut you off saying, "No, no, it was me. I shouldn't," and things are okay. Easy. How about when everyone's trying to patch things up after your people have slaughtered 3/4 of theirs? Or after they came as colonials, stole your land, and forced you to live in slum homelands for decades? Trickier. We're the only species that institutionalizes reconciliation and that grapples with truth, apology, forgiveness, reparations, amnesty, and forgetting. The apogee of institutionalized complexity is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, TRC. The first came in the 1980s, and they've been depressingly useful ever since, occurring, for example, in Bolivia, Canada, Australia, Nepal, Rwanda, and Poland. Some TRCs have been in stable countries, Canada and Australia, facing up to their long history of abuse of indigenous peoples. Most, however, have come after a nation emerged from a bloody, divisive transition. A dictator overthrown, a civil war settled, a genocide halted. The popular perception is that their purpose is for perpetrators of abuse to confess, express remorse, and beg for forgiveness from victims, who then grant it, resulting in tearful embraces between the two. But instead, TRCs are typically exercises in pragmatism, where perpetrators basically say, "This is what I did, and I vow to never harm your people again." And the victims basically say, "Okay, we vow to not seek extrajudicial retribution." An often towering achievement, if less heartwarming. Probably the best-studied TRC was South Africa's after the defeat of apartheid. It came with enormous moral legitimacy, being overseen by Desmond Tutu, and gained further legitimacy by, though overwhelmingly focusing on the acts of whites, also examining atrocities by African liberation fighters. Hearings were public and included victims getting to tell their stories. More than 6,000 of the perpetrators testified and applied for amnesty. This was granted to 13%. What happened to the tearful forgiveness scenarios? What about perpetrators at least showing remorse for their actions? It was not required, and few did. The goal was not to transform those individuals. It was to increase the odds that the shattered nation would function. In follow-up studies by the South African Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, victim participants commonly felt that the TRC had been more successful at the national than the local level. Many were outraged that there were no apologies, no reparations, that many perpetrators remained in their jobs. Interestingly, echoing Chapter 15, many were equally angry about symbolic changes that had not occurred. Not only is this killer still a cop, but there's still a holiday-slash-monument-slash-street name celebrating apartheid. A wide majority of black, but not white, South Africans saw the TRC as fair and successful, and it accompanied South Africa's miraculously transitioning to freedom, rather than descending into civil war. Thus, TRCs show the differences between reconciliation and the likes of remorse and forgiveness. As every parent knows, a transparently insincere apology accomplishes little and can even worsen things. But deep remorse is different. The New Yorker recounts the story of Lou Lobello, an American Iraq War veteran, who accidentally killed three members of a family, collateral damage during a firefight. Haunted by it, he spent 9 years tracking down the survivors to apologize. Or consider Hazel Brian Massery, the snarling white teenager at the center of the iconic 1957 civil rights movement photograph of Elizabeth Eckford attempting to integrate Little Rock Central High School. A few years later, Massery contacted Eckford to apologize. Do apologies work? It depends. One issue is what the person is apologizing for, ranging from the concrete, "I'm sorry I broke your toy," to the global and essentialist, "I'm sorry I viewed your people as not fully human." Another is what the apologizer aims to do about their remorse. And there's the makeup of the recipient of the apology. Studies show that, A, victims who are oriented toward the workings of a collective system respond most to apologies that emphasize failure of that system. "I'm sorry, we police are supposed to protect, not break laws." B, victims most oriented to relationships respond most to apologies that are empathic. "I'm sorry for the pain that I caused you, for taking your son." And C, victims who are most autonomous and independent respond most to apologies accompanied by offers of compensation. There is also the issue of who is apologizing. What does it mean that in 1993, Bill Clinton apologized to Japanese Americans for their World War II internment? While the apology was laudable and accompanied by reparative money, Could Clinton speak for FDR? The issue of reparations is immensely complicated. At one extreme, reparations can be the ultimate proof of sincerity. This is at the heart of the slavery reparations movement. So much of America's growth into economic privilege was built on slavery, and so many of the subsequent benefits of the successful economy have been systematically denied to African Americans that there should be reparations to the descendants of slaves. At the other extreme, reparations meant to purchase forgiveness offend. This was the reasoning behind the newly born state of Israel's refusal of reparations from Germany, unless it was accompanied by adequate remorse. At the end of these steps might arise one of the strangest things humans do. We forgive. For starters, forgiving is not forgetting. If nothing else, that's neurobiologically unlikely. A rat learns to associate a bell with a shock and freezes when he hears it. When the next day the bell repeatedly sounds without being accompanied by a shock, causing the freezing behavior to extinguish, the memory trace of that learning does not evaporate. Instead, it is overlaid with newer learning. Today, the bell is not bad news. As proof, suppose that the day after that, the bell again signals shock. If the initial learning of bell equals shock had been erased, it would take as long this day to learn the association as it did the first. Instead, there is rapid reacquisition. Bell equals shock again. Forgiving someone doesn't mean you've forgotten what he did. There is a subset of victim who claim to have forgiven the perpetrator, to have relinquished their anger and desire for punishment. I include the word claim not to imply skepticism, but to indicate that forgiveness is a self-reported state that can be claimed but not proven. Forgiveness can occur as a religious imperative. In the June 2015 Charleston Church Massacre, white supremacist Dylan Roof killed 9 parishioners at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. 2 days later, at Roof's arraignment, stunningly, family members of the dead were there to forgive him and pray for his soul. Forgiveness can take extraordinary cognitive reappraisal. Consider the case of Jennifer Thompson Canino and Ronald Cotton. In 1984, Thompson Canino was raped by a stranger. In a police lineup, she identified Cotton with great certainty. Despite claiming innocence, he was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. In the years after, friends tentatively wondered if she could now put the nightmare behind her. "Like hell I'm able to," would be her response. She was consumed with her hatred for Cotton, with her desire to harm him. And then, more than 10 years into his prison sentence, DNA evidence exonerated Cotton. Another man had done it. He was incarcerated in Cotton's prison for other rapes and bragged about getting away with this one. Thompson Canino had identified the wrong man and convinced a jury. Issues of hatred or forgiveness were now on the other foot. When they finally met, after Cotton's release and pardon, Thompson Canino said, "If I spent every minute of every hour of every day for the rest of my life telling you that I'm sorry, can you ever forgive me?" And Cotton said, "Jennifer, I forgave you years ago." His ability to do so involved profound reappraisal. Forgiving Jennifer for picking me out of that lineup as a rapist took less time than people think. I knew she was a victim and was hurting real bad. We were the victims of the same injustice by the same man, and this gave us a common ground to stand on. A complete reappraisal that made them us in their victimhood. The two now lecture together about the need for judicial reform. Ultimately, forgiveness is usually about one thing. This is for me, not for you. Hatred is exhausting. Forgiveness, or even just indifference, is freeing. To quote Booker T. Washington, "I shall allow no man to belittle my soul by making me hate him." Belittle and distort and consume. Forgiveness seems to be at least somewhat good for your health. Victims who show spontaneous forgiveness, or who have gone through forgiveness therapy, as opposed to anger validation therapy, show improvements in general health, cardiovascular function, and symptoms of depression, anxiety, and PTSD. Chapter 14 explored how compassion readily, perhaps inevitably, contains elements of self-interest, the compassionate granting of forgiveness epitomizes this. We've now focused on forgiveness, apology, reparation, reconciliation, and the extent to which TRCs were about reconciliation rather than forgiveness. What about the truth part? It facilitates the healing process enormously. In the TRCs, perpetrators spilling truth, detailed, exhaustive, unflinching, and public, was the highest priority for victims. It's the need to know what happened. It's getting the villain to say the words. It's to show the world, look what they did to us. Recognizing our irrationalities. Despite the claims of some economists, we are not rational optimization machines. We are more generous in games than logic predicts. We decide if someone is guilty based on reasoning, but then decide their punishment based on emotion. Roughly half of us make different decisions about sacrificing one to save five, depending if it involves pushing a person versus pulling a lever. We effortlessly resist cheating in circumstances where no one would know. We make strong moral decisions without being able to explain why. Thus, it's a good idea to recognize the systematic features to our irrationality. Sometimes we aim to eliminate these irrationalities. Perhaps the most fundamental one is the common visceral resistance to a simple fact. You don't make treaties with friends. It's to be expected that you passionately hate those whose hands you are about to shake, and that can't be an impediment to doing so. Another domain concerns discrepancies between our conscious opinions and what our implicit biases lead us to do. As we saw, us-them edges can be softened when implicit biases are made explicit. Doing so need not eliminate that bias. After all, you can't readily reason yourself out of a belief that you weren't originally reasoned into. Instead, revealing implicit biases indicates where to focus your monitoring to lessen their impact. This notion can be applied to all the realms of our behaviors being shaped by something implicit, subliminal, interoceptive, unconscious, subterranean, and where we then post hoc rationalize our stance. For example, every judge should learn that judicial decisions are sensitive to how long it's been since they ate. Another example to watch out for is the human potential for irrational optimism. For example, while people might accurately assess the risk of a behavior, they tend toward distortive optimism when assessing risk to themselves. Nah, that couldn't happen to me. Irrational optimism can be great. It's why only about 15% instead of 99% of humans get clinically depressed. But as emphasized by the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman, irrational optimism in warfare is disastrous. This can range from the theologically optimistic conviction that God is on your side to the tendency of military strategists to overestimate their side's capabilities and underestimate those of the opposition. Piece of cake, full steam ahead, becomes the logical conclusion. A final domain of irrationality that must be recognized concerns Chapter 15's sacred values, where purely symbolic acts can count for more than hard-nosed material concessions. Rationality may be key to establishing peace, but the irrational importance of sacred values is key to establishing lasting peace. Our incompetence at, and aversion to, killing. Video cameras are sufficiently ubiquitous these days to make privacy a threatened phenomenon. One consequence of such ubiquity is that scientists can be voyeuristic in new ways, which has produced an interesting finding. It concerns riots in soccer stadiums, football hooliganism, battles between ethnic or nationalist groups, partisans of each team, or often right-wing skinheads going at it. Footage of such events shows that few people actually fight. Most are on the sidelines, watching, or running around like agitated, headless chickens. Of those who fight, most throw an ineffectual punch or two before discovering that punching makes your hand hurt. The actual fighters are a tiny subset. As stated by one researcher, humans are bad at close-range, hand-to-hand violence, even if civilization makes us a bit better at it. Even more interesting, is the evidence of our strong inhibitions against doing grievous harm to someone up close. The definitive exploration of this is the 1995 book On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society by David Grossman, a professor of military science and retired U.S. Army colonel. He frames the book around something noted after the Battle of Gettysburg. Of the almost 27,000 single-load muskets recovered from the field, almost 24,000 of them were loaded and done fired. 12,000 were loaded multiple times. 6,000 loaded 3 to 10 times. Lots of soldiers were standing there thinking, "I'm going to shoot soon. Yes, I am. Maybe I should reload my rifle first." These weapons were recovered from the thick of the battlefield, from men whose lives were at risk while they were reloading. In Gettysburg, most deaths were caused by artillery, not the infantry on the ground. In the heat of crazed battle, most men would load, tend to the wounded, shout orders, run away, or wander in a daze. Similarly, in World War II, only 15 to 20% of riflemen ever fired their guns. The rest, running messages, helping people load ammunition, tending to buddies, but not aiming a rifle at someone nearby and pulling a trigger. Psychologists of warfare emphasize how, in the heat of battle, people don't shoot another human out of hatred or obedience, or even from knowing that this enemy is trying to kill them. Instead, it's the pseudo-kinship of bands of brothers, to protect your buddies, to not let the guys next to you down. But outside those motivations, humans show a strong natural aversion to killing at close range. The most resistance is against hand-to-hand combat with a knife or bayonet. Next comes short-range firing with a pistol, then long-range firing, all the way to the easiest, which is bombs and artillery. The resistance can be psychologically modified. It's easier when you aren't targeting an identified individual, throwing a grenade into a group rather than shooting at one person. Killing as an individual is harder than in a group. While only that small subset of World War II riflemen fired their weapons, nearly all weapons operated by a team, e.g. machine guns, were fired. Responsibility is diluted, much as when a firing squad would know that one of them had received a blank, allowing every shooter to know that they might not have actually killed someone. Grossman's premise is supported by something new and startling. Since it morphed from battle fatigue or shell shock into a formal psychiatric illness, combat PTSD has been framed as a result of the sheer terror of being under attack, of someone trying to kill you and those around you. As we've seen, it is an illness where fear conditioning is overgeneralized and pathological, an amygdala grown large, hyperreactive, and convinced that you are never safe. But consider drone pilots, soldiers who sit in control rooms in the United States, directing drones on the other side of the planet. They are not in danger. Yet their rates of PTSD are just as high as those of soldiers actually in war. Why? Drone pilots do something horrifying and fascinating, a type of close-range, intimate killing like nothing in history, using imaging technology of extraordinary quality. A target is identified, and a drone might be positioned invisibly high in the sky over the person's house for weeks, the drone operators always watching, waiting, say, for a gathering of targets in the house. You watch the target coming and going, eating dinner, taking a nap on his deck, playing with his kids, and then comes the command to fire, to release your Hellfire missile at supersonic speed. Here's one drone pilot describing his first kill. 3 Afghanis targeted from his Air Force base in Nevada. The missile has hit, and he watches through an infrared camera which transmits heat signatures. The smoke clears, and there's pieces of the two guys around the crater. And there's this guy over here, and he's missing his right leg above his knee. He's holding it, and he's rolling around, and the blood is squirting out of his leg, and it's hitting the ground, and it's hot. His blood is hot. But when it hits the ground, it starts to cool off. The pool cools fast. It took him a long time to die. I just watched him. I watched him become the same color as the ground he was lying on. But there would be more. Pilots wait to see who retrieves the bodies, who comes to the funeral, ready to perhaps release another strike. Or in other circumstances, the pilot might watch as an American convoy approaches a roadside IED booby trap, unable to warn them, or watch insurgents execute a shrieking civilian begging for mercy. The pilot above was 21 when he made that first kill. He would eventually accumulate 1,626 drone-mediated kills. Footnote. And it should be noted, there's enormous controversy as to what percentage of kills are accidents, collateral damage to innocent bystanders. Estimates range from 2 to 20%. No personal danger. An omnipresent eye in the sky. He could finish his shift and get a donut on the way home. Yet he and many of his fellow drone pilots succumbed to devastating PTSD. After reading Grossman, the explanation is simple. The deepest trauma is not the fear of being killed. It's doing the close-up, individuated killing, watching someone for weeks and then turning him the color of the ground. Grossman cites that during World War II, there were low rates of psychiatric breakdowns among sailors and medics, people who were just as endangered as